From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley, broadcasting today from member station KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Iran's foreign minister had a warning today. Mohammad Javad Zarif told CNN that if the U.S. or Saudi Arabia strikes Iran, the consequence will be, quote, all-out war.
I'm making a very serious statement that we don't want war. We don't want to engage in a military confrontation. But we won't blink to defend our territory.
Those comments came after that attack last weekend on Saudi oil installations. The U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has said Iran is to blame. Iran denies that. Joining us now is Jane Harman, president and CEO of the Wilson Center. She was the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee during her time in Congress. Welcome back.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And where do you see this headed with the U.S. and Iran?
Well, I think it's tough talk, but it will be much more modest action. And I think that's a good thing. I think what we'll end up doing is ratcheting up sanctions, and we may ratchet up some asymmetric attacks, think cyber. But I don't think we're heading for all-out war. I don't think Trump wants it. And I would point out the irony that if we had stayed in the Iran nuclear deal, the 2015 deal, I think we would be in a much stronger position now to ask more from Iran. And I think Iran would have been willing to do it. And we would have had a coalition on our side. Now we are fairly isolated, and I think we have a weaker hand.
Do you think that the U.S. may try to get back into another nuclear deal with Iran at the end of all of this?
Yes. I don't know about back. I mean, I don't think Trump would ever want to admit that any deal he made had some resemblance to the Obama deal. I think our foreign policy is anything but Obama 24/7. But I think if there is a deal to be made that fences Iran's nuclear activity for a longer period of time than the old deal, that it reins in Iran's missile testing and activity, which wasn't covered, and that reins in some of its malign behavior in the region, I think that's a better deal. But again, I think we would have achieved it more easily by staying in the old deal, which, let me point out, too, a majority of members of Congress supported staying in the old deal, whether or not they were advocates initially of the old deal.
What do you think that Iran is taking from what I would call mixed messages from the United States? You've got Mike Pompeo saying that Iran is to blame for the attacks. President Trump has not gone that far.
Right. I don't know the intelligence case. I think Pompeo got to Iran as responsible faster than perhaps the intelligence proved. But I also think not being definitive is giving us some wiggle room in coming up with a policy short of all-out war, which, again, I think Trump doesn't want to do and I think is probably a really bad idea. So leaving the wiggle room is useful right now to us. I think the current claim, at least in the public claim, is that these drones were launched from Iran, not from Yemen, even though the Yemenis have claimed responsibility. I don't know that there's definitive proof yet that that was the case. They would have flown over a lot of airspace, and I think we'll know when we know. But I'm one who thinks that the intelligence case really matters. When we get it right, we have better policy. When we get it wrong, as we did in Iraq, we have worse policy.
If Iran did do this, why would they do this?
Well, I think Iran is trying to get our attention. The sanctions are biting, and they're getting our attention. So
that
why
they can
would
get
they
into another deal?
Well, I think North Korea does the same thing. North Korea does provocative tests, and then we talk to them. So I think they think this may be the playbook with Trump. It also points out to me, by the way, something we should factor in, how weak the Saudi defenses are. And most people think, by the way, that their fighting capacity, even though they've bought billions of dollars of military assets from us, is poor. And that in Yemen, the progress that was made, I don't know if we really call that progress, but in the civil war there, the fighters who were impressive were UAE fighters, not Saudi fighters.
Finally, I want to ask you about another powerful player in the Middle East. That would be Israel. There was an election this week, a sort of re-election, right? Exactly. And it delivered a big setback to the longtime Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. Do you think he's finished as Prime Minister?
I think we don't know yet, but I certainly think the hill that he's climbing got steeper. And if he has the same number of seats or maybe one down from the Blue and White Party, the Gantz Party, and they get a chance to form the coalition, I think they have a decent shot at forming a coalition that is not just with far-right parties. And frankly, I don't want to say, I think Bibi Netanyahu has offered some bold leadership over the years, but I also think he has made it much harder to achieve a two-state solution, which I am strongly for. And I think that there is an indictment, you know, over his head, which may come in 2 weeks. I think that Israelis may have decided to move on, and I think moving on could deliver something I'm strongly for, which is a better chance for Israel to be a pluralist democracy in a very small piece of real estate, which also offers the possibility of a separate Palestinian state with secure borders and responsible leadership. Understand, I just said secure borders and responsible leadership. That may not be achievable, but if the parties on the ground there can get to that, I think that would be, frankly, more in Israel's interest than an option of annexing more land.
Jane Harman, Director, President, and CEO of the Wilson Center. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy. Have a good day.
Let's turn now to some research about toddlers and dairy. Guidelines released this week by a panel of health organizations say that kids under the age of 5 should not drink plant-based milk in replacement of dairy milk. That includes beverages derived from rice, oats, almonds, or coconut. Some soy milk can be an exception. NPR Senior Science Desk Editor Maria Godoy joins us now. Hi, Maria.
Hi, Tanya.
So we know that kids under 5 get a lot of their daily nutrition through beverages. There's so many choices now more than ever before. Why is this panel cautioning against most plant-based milks?
So, yeah, the whole plant-based milk sector has been growing in popularity, and they have everything from peas to almonds to coconuts, as you said. But the panel says most of these products don't have the same nutritional profile as dairy milk. For instance, they may lack the same levels of protein or vitamin D or calcium or phosphorus. And these are nutrients that are really vital to proper growth and development for kids who are 5 years old and under. Some of these plant-based milks may actually be fortified, but so that their nutritional profile is made to match dairy milk. But the panel also says there's actually not enough evidence to know if these nutrients are bioavailable in the same way. And what that means is if they're readily absorbed by the body in the same way that they would be from dairy milk.
I want to get to some alternatives, but first I want to know what organizations make up this panel.
One of the organizations, this was actually an expert panel drawn from leading health organizations, including the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Heart Association, the American Academy of Pediatric Dentists, and the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. They were convened by a nutrition research group called Healthy Eating Research with funding by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And I should note that the same foundation also provides funding for NPR.
Okay. What are some of the best alternatives if you don't want your child to drink cow's milk or if they can't, really?
Well, so the if they can't is a big issue because of obviously there's dairy allergies, there's milk allergies, and there's also lactose intolerant. And there are kids who grow up in vegan households. Mm-hmm. One of the things that the panel said is that soy milk can be used as an exclusive replacement for dairy milk. The evidence for its nutritional profile was stronger. Also, if your kid can't drink dairy for medical reasons or vegan or reasons of being vegan, you can have plant-based milks, but then really talk to your pediatrician or a dietitian or a nutritionist to figure out what else your kids should be eating in their diet to make sure they're getting those key nutrients from other sources.
Even with soy milks and some of the other milks, they may have higher sugar content, or there's just a plethora of choices out there. And you go to the aisle and you see you have to really look to find the unsweetened versions of those.
Right. I mean, that's another big concern why this group was issuing cautions against plant-based milk is that a lot of them are sweetened, and that's adding sugars to the diet. And there's a ton of research showing that these early years is when kids' palates form, so they may grow more used to sweetened drinks. They don't need sugar in the diet. None of us really need added sugar in our diet. So, yeah, we should always be watching labels, right?
The panel also says that we should really limit fruit juice because of the high sugar content as well.
Right. And this is a big thing of mine because I think juice still has a halo, but it is high in sugar and calories. Mm-hmm. However, juice can help meet some of those daily fruit intake for kids, and especially where affordability is an issue, because whole fruit can be more expensive than juice. They do say you can have it if you're limiting it, you know, to 4 to 6 ounces a day.
NPR Senior Science Desk Editor Maria Godoy, thank you so much. We could talk about this forever.
What happens when Ronald McDonald walks into a poor immigrant neighborhood in the south of France and sets off a supersized revolution? The story of how a company slogan to sell more shakes and burgers became a rallying cry for workers in France. That's on NPR's Rough Translation.
You could call him the man at the center of Brexit. He sits right in the middle of the two sides in the House of Commons and often has to calm everyone down.
Now I order! Order!
Speaker of the House of Commons John Bercow has been in that role since 2009, but now he could be a crucial check on the power of the Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who wants to take the UK out of the European Union, deal or no deal, on October 31st. Parliament voted against a no-deal Brexit, but right now Parliament is suspended by the order of Johnson, a move Bercow called a constitutional outrage. John Bercow joins me now here in the studio. Welcome.
Jeremy, good afternoon to you, and thank you.
So I want to ask you, first of all, about the news of the day. You said in a lecture the other day that the only form of Brexit that we have, whenever that might be, will be a Brexit that the House of Commons has explicitly endorsed, and that you'll do what you have to do to keep the Prime Minister from ignoring Parliament and taking the UK out of the EU without a deal. What does that mean?
It simply means that there are three possibilities as the Brexit debate continues and moves towards perhaps an initial conclusion as far as withdrawal is concerned. First, there can be a withdrawal agreement approved by Parliament and therefore an exit with a deal. Mm-hmm. Secondly, there could be a withdrawal from the European Union without a deal if no deal is approved by the House of Commons, if the House of Commons explicitly endorses the idea of a no-deal Brexit.
Which they've
explicitly not done
so far. In other
words, it doesn't happen by default, it happens by explicit endorsement. Thirdly, there could be a scenario in which Parliament says, we haven't approved a deal, we don't want to leave without a deal, so we want an extension of Article 50 to find a route to a potential mechanism to sort the issue once and for all. So there are those three possibilities. The simple point that I was making was that we cannot have a situation in which we leave the European Union by default. The House of Commons will want to be in the driving seat, stating explicitly and emphatically and unmistakably what it wants. That is my only point.
There's concern about that right now, that maybe the Prime Minister would just ignore the law that was just passed in the House of Commons and signed by the Queen that says that he cannot leave without a deal on the 31st of October.
Well, I think everybody accepts that a law is binding and everyone has to adhere to the law, period. Be you ever so high, the law is above you.
Tell me about the role of the Speaker, because, you know, people are looking to you in a way to make sure that the law is abided by in this case.
The principal function of the Speaker of the House of Commons is to chair in the chamber, to chair Prime Minister's questions, to chair other question time sessions, to chair the delivery of ministerial statements, to chair debates on a vast miscellany of different topics. In that capacity, the Speaker is not a player in the match, but it's referee or umpire. That's the function of the Speaker, not to try to secure one outcome or another, but to facilitate the House of Commons in order that it can arrive at the decision which, by a clear majority, it wishes to reach.
So what do you say to people who think that you have gotten too political in the role of Speaker?
Well, I simply reject that charge. I don't think I've been too political at all. I have not argued for a particular point of view on the Brexit issue in the chamber of the House of Commons. At different times, there have been important minorities to accommodate in the debate. So the Brexiteers had their chance when they were in a minority. Now the dissenting view of the soft Brexiteers or the would-be Remainers has also to be heard. So the point that I'm making to you is that the Speaker has to try to ensure that all of the different voices are heard. It's not for the Speaker to implement the government's position. It's not for the Speaker to implement the opposition's position. It's not for the Speaker to implement any particular view. The Speaker's job is to try to ensure that the different points of view are heard. I think the truth of the matter, if I may put it this way, very fairly, is that sometimes when people have their own view heard, when they desperately need it to be heard, they're pleased. When somebody else's view, which is in very hot competition with their own, is given an airing,
they don't want
when
to
they would prefer it not to be, they're quick to criticise. The Speaker's job is not to court popularity, but to try to facilitate colleagues.
And to say the word that you've become famous for, which is, I'm going to let you do it.
Order! Order! The House must come to order.
Now, did all the previous speakers do it like that, or have you put your own stamp on it?
Oh, I think everybody puts his or her own stamp on it. My predecessor, Michael Martin, was a Scottish Labour Member of Parliament, and he had a distinctive Scottish accent. He said the word in his way. Betty Boothroyd, the first and so far the only female speaker, had her own iteration of the word. Everybody does it differently. I don't say that mine is preferable to anybody else's, but it's simply mine.
As you have been Speaker for so long and throughout the whole Brexit process, if we think of Brexit as like a ship in a storm right now, where are we? Is this the most dramatic part so far that you've been there? How does this feel compared to right after the referendum happened a few years ago?
Well, it feels different. And yes, this is the most dramatic point that we have reached to date. But in that first part of my sentence, the words to date are of the essence. Nobody knows what is going to come next. And I think what I would say to you is that anybody who predicts with certainty or even alacrity the eventual resolution of Brexit and when that will be is either an extraordinarily clever person or, frankly, a reckless fool.
Are you allowed to have a public, personal opinion about what should happen with Brexit?
Not in terms of the outcome, only in terms of the process. I can have a view about the process, and in my view, it is absolutely critical in the efficient, effective, and responsible functioning of a parliamentary democracy that the House of Commons takes ownership of the issue and has its say.
Well, one of the fears that people – and we've covered Brexit a lot on this program. One of the fears I think that people who don't want Britain to leave the EU have is that Britain is going to lose its place kind of at the table of all the major decisions that happen in the world. We think of the UK as one of the leaders right now, and that if it's not part of the EU anymore, that it's going to lose some of that clout. Notwithstanding the fact that you can't tell me what you think should happen – Do you think that the UK has lost any of its global stature through all of this drama over the last few years?
Well, that is a sophisticated and charming way of seeking to inveigle me into expressing a view on a matter
I love
upon
your vocabulary,
which I should not
by the
pronounce.
Way.
What I will say to you, Jeremy, is look, I have heard that view. We are really approaching only the end of the beginning. We're talking here, and it's important for your listeners to be conscious of this, about a potential withdrawal agreement to be submitted to the House for its possible approval. That is really stage one.
could go
even
on for years after that.
Even if there were a withdrawal agreement approved, and that remains to be seen, there is a whole discussion to be had about trade relations, about security cooperation, about cultural relations between the United Kingdom and the European Union, and the approach that the United Kingdom adopts to the rest of the world. So I think it is very important that as soon as possible, in the interests of a wider set of issues, a whole gamut of topics being addressed by government and parliament, there is bandwidth for education and for transport and the fight against crime and doing what we can to bolster our social care system and so on and so forth. But the idea that it is a question in the next few weeks of simply sorting Brexit, the issue of our future relationship with Europe and with the rest of the world as a consequence of this subject having been addressed, will be a staple feature of UK political discourse for a long time to come.
Let me just finally ask you, you're going to leave the speakership at the end of this parliament. What are you going to miss the most about it?
The cut and thrust of debate, listening to my colleagues, disagreeing, sometimes fiercely, occasionally angrily, putting their points with real passion. I respect that. And although, of course, I understand a lot of people are very frustrated, I hugely admire my colleagues. I believe that the House of Commons is a wonderful place. It is overwhelmingly filled by people who are motivated, motivated by their notion of the national interest, by their perception of the public good, and by their duty, not as delegates, but as representatives, to do what they judge to be right for our country. If you do for a living something that causes you to jump out of bed in the morning looking forward to the day ahead, as I've done for the last 22 years as a Member of Parliament and the last 10 as Speaker, frankly, you are blessed. I have no plans to die tomorrow, but if I were to die tomorrow, I would die happy, feeling I've been incredibly lucky. And that's what causes me to say to all of my colleagues, those who've supported me and those who have not, thank you.
That is John Bercow, the Speaker of the British House of Commons. Thank you so much for joining us.
Jeremy, thank you.
And you can see a photo of the Speaker in our offices at hereandnow.org.
Southeastern Texas is underwater. That sound of a flooding highway near Cleveland, Texas, about 50 miles outside of Houston. The remnants of Tropical Depression Imelda is dumping heavy rain throughout southeastern Texas and southwest Louisiana, causing major flooding there since Tuesday. There's so much water in Texas, some local officials there say this flooding is worse than what they've experienced during Hurricane Harvey. For more on this, let's bring in Gail DeLauder. She's a transportation reporter for Houston Public Media. Hi, Gail.
Hi, Tanya.
I know that there's so much going on there right now. We know that the Houston area has about 4 to 5 floods a year, but give us a sense of how this storm compares and what you're seeing.
Well, you know, it really depends on how much rainfall you get in your particular area and also what waterways you're near, if you're going to flood or not, if you're going to have water in your home or if you're going to have water on the roadway that impacts your ability to get around. Basically, what we're seeing right now, to kind of give you a picture of what's happening, here in downtown Houston, a lot of people came to work today. A lot of schools are still in session, so people are kind of, you know, still trying to go about their business. But a lot of the action right now is to the north and the east of Houston. We're seeing a lot of flooding going on in areas about 50 miles east of Houston in the community of Winnie, a smaller community there. Also, they've had problems since overnight in the Beaumont area. That's a little bit larger city, about 80 miles to the east of Houston. Here in the city proper, we're getting reports right now of some fairly high water in some of the northeastern suburbs, reports of water going into homes, also people getting stranded in their neighborhoods. The big airport, Bush Intercontinental, they've come to a total ground stop. And there was also a lot of flooding around the airport as well. We just saw a photo that someone put out on social media of one of the Metro transit buses totally flooded. So it's not only the planes right. getting in and out, but people actually physically getting to the airport.
Yeah, and we saw that Houston Bush Airport is back open, but flights are still delayed, and the roads surrounding the airport, as you mentioned, are flooded. You also mentioned Beaumont. So the Beaumont Police Department tweeted that the 911 Operations Center is experiencing heavy calls, more than 250 high water rescues and nearly 300 evacuation requests. How are those water rescues going?
Well, they're getting to as many as they can. You've got the fire department, police department, other entities. You know, since we're on the coast, all of these communities have emergency plans for weather events like this. It can kind of come up by surprise. But then there gets to a point where you need some help from outside. So what we see in a lot of these flooding events is civilians going out in their boats to do rescues. We have the organization you've probably heard about called the Cajun Navy from Louisiana, a group of volunteers who goes, they go to different places to do water rescues. So there comes a point where civilians with boats are pressed into service to handle a lot of these rescues.
There's so much going on there. We are also hearing reports of tornadoes happening. And then there are the impacts to hospitals and nursing homes. And I guess that's where all those civilians come into play, assisting folks as well as officials assisting folks. You stay safe out there. Thank you so much for this update. That's Gail DeLauder. She's transportation reporter for Houston Public Media. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
If you look up Louis Ziska's name on the Department of Agriculture website, you won't find his biography. That's because after more than two decades working as one of the department's top scientists looking at how climate change affects plants, Ziska quit, saying the Trump administration was trying to silence his research. Louis Ziska is now an associate professor at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University and joins us. Professor, welcome.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, let's start with the research. What was it that the Trump administration, you say, didn't want to get out?
We were looking at how rising carbon dioxide levels have an impact with respect to nutrition. And we wanted to focus on rice because rice is one of the primary staples globally. Prior to submitting the paper, of course, we have to get permission from higher ups at the national program level, and the paper was accepted. As part of the overall process, once the paper had been peer-reviewed and was getting ready to publish, the editor approached us and said, look, you know, we think this is going to get a lot of press. Would you mind doing a press release? And of course, we said, no, no problem. But after the press release was put in, we were told that, no, the conclusions of the paper were not supported by the data. If you had a problem with the paper, you would have done it initially, not something that you do after the paper's been accepted. So it indicated to me that they were not going to support the scientific findings. Even more than that, they went out of their way to touch base with other groups that were involved in this and also urged them not to do a press release. And to me, that was sort of crossing an ethical line in terms of what you can do.
Well, and I want to get to the politics of this in a minute. But first of all, what were the conclusions?
The conclusions were that as CO2 has been rising, if you look at the integrative nutritional content of rice, what we found was that the protein levels are going down, that key elements such as iron and zinc that are important for human health are also declining, and that at least for some of the data, we didn't have a chance to do this for all the different sites, but for the ones we did, what we found was that there was a drop in B vitamin content, and rice is an important source of B vitamins for many people in the world. And we focused on those countries in the world that were more than 50% of their calories come from rice alone, countries like Bangladesh or Laos or others, at least 50% of your diet comes from only from rice. So those are the ones that we felt were most susceptible to the CO2-induced change. Now, these were data that were obtained in the field. They were data for CO2 concentrations that we are almost certain will happen before the end of the current century. So the fact that it's going to have an impact on the health or potential health of over 600 million we thought was something that was obviously important.
Why does the climate and the carbon in the atmosphere have an effect on the nutrients in rice and other plants?
What we think is happening is that plants are very adaptable to their environment. They can't exactly pull up their roots and run away. Mm-hmm. So what they do is they change chemically. And what's happening right now is an unprecedented increase in carbon in the air. It's not keeping pace with other elements such as nitrogen and phosphorus and potassium that come from the soil. So what we're seeing in a number of different instances is that those compounds that require a lot of carbon may be benefited by the change in carbon. But those that require like more nitrogen or more phosphorus, in fact, may be going down. So when we looked at the nutritional profile of rice, what we found was that vitamin E, tocopherol, was actually going up. Now, that's a compound that is only carbon, so it may benefit by the rise in CO2, whereas something like vitamin B9, B12, which have a lot of nitrogen, were actually going down. So what this implies is, not just for rice, but for all plants at the bottom of the food chain, is that as CO2 changes, they may be adapting in that in a way that's going to affect their basic chemistry. And that, of course, has implications for not only human health, but for all animals who rely on plants as their primary source of food.
And are all of those adaptations, as far as you know, going to be for the worse for human health?
Not necessarily. So if we see, for example, that vitamin E is going up, then that may have a benefit. But one of the things that's most worrisome about what we're observing is the change in protein. And what we find is that protein concentrations are going down across the board. Now, you can argue, and some have, that this change in protein is a result of breeding for higher and higher yields and crops. But we also went to the Smithsonian Natural History Museum, and you look at some of the samples that were taken 150 years ago, prior to the start of the industrial age. And we were looking at not people food, but we were looking at solidago or goldenrod. And goldenrod pollen is a major source of nutrition for bees, for pollinators. And what we found there was that in addition to what we had been observing for rice and other crops, is a similar decline in protein for the pollen. And that has implications for bee health and pollinator mm-hmm. health as well. So we can't say it's universally awful. What we're saying is that plants, which are the basis of all life, are changing. And how they're changing is going to have implications not only for human health, but also for the environment as a whole.
So to the politics of this, the U.S. Department of Agriculture has denied having suppressed any climate change-related reports or information. And in response to your resignation, the department said that preventing the promotion of your study was not political, but was instead based on scientific disagreement. How do you respond to that?
If there was an issue of scientific disagreement, then prior to my submitting the paper, they should have come to me and said, oh, we don't think the science here is feasible. We don't think the science is appropriate. They didn't do that. They did it after it's gone through peer review. You don't do that after the paper is getting ready to be published. The people that disagreed with it, to the best of my knowledge, are not people that have any background in looking at climate change or carbon dioxide effects on nutrition. The person who contacted me to tell me about it was actually a soil scientist, not someone who had published in this area at all. So this doesn't sound like they're disagreeing with the science. It sounds to me that they're disagreeing with the outcome of the study and the fact that the study did not fall into what their political purview was. So it was very unusual. This had never, I've been with, as you mentioned in your intro, been with USDA for over 20 years. Mm-hmm. This had never happened like this before. I, of course, responded by saying, hey, let's meet. Let's talk about this. And there was no follow-up meeting. There was no effort to come back and say specifically how what happened or why it suddenly at this point in the process was not acceptable. It made no sense.
Now, you're not the only government employee to recently leave over the issue of climate change. Do you think that you're going to have a bigger impact on this issue outside the government than you could inside?
The sad part is that I think I will, but the sad part of that is that there are very good people that are still at USDA, good scientists, good technicians who can make a difference. But if you're not allowed to work on this, if you're steered away from doing this kind of research, then what impact are you going to have? And yet, at the same time, you have, in real terms, you have farmers that are dealing with unprecedented rainfall. You have farmers that are dealing with unprecedented pest threats to their production. And you have, on the other hand, folks at the Agricultural Research Service. They're good people that can do a lot in this regard. But you're not going to use them because it's politically inconvenient to begin to address a problem that the administration believes is not a problem. It just isn't right. This is what USDA and other scientists at the federal level are there for, is to help address problems of national importance. To ignore those problems, to say, oh no, that's political, that's not science, that's not evidence-based. I don't have the words to express why that's so wrong, why that hurts so many people, not just the scientists, but ourselves as a country, in terms of our ability to be a sustainable producer of major food crops for the world as a whole. Yes, I can, from a personal level, I'm very, very grateful for Columbia to take me in. But from a larger perspective, I think it's going to hurt the research that needs to be done overall to begin to address these challenges to food security.
That is Louis Ziska, who is now an associate professor at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University. He quit his job as a scientist at the Department of Agriculture. Louis Ziska, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And you can hear more of our stories from Covering Climate Now at hereandnow.org.
Nine states have the death penalty, and more than 2,600 people are on death row. Until recently, that included Tennessee inmate Abdul Ali Abdurrahman. But in August, more than three decades after he was sentenced, a judge there reversed Abdurrahman's scheduled execution for first-degree murder. He was given a sentence of life imprisonment, citing questions about the fairness of his trial. The ruling ended a drawn-out legal process that took a toll on the defendant and the victims, and it's become a common scenario in capital cases. Samantha Max of member station WPLN reports from Nashville.
When Abu Ali Abdurrahman and an accomplice stormed into Shawana Norman's house in February of 1986, Norman hid in a bedroom. She and her sister Katrina, who were 9 and 8 at the time, could hear everything as their mother and her boyfriend were attacked.
We were so scared when I ran back in the room and told my sister that it was men in the living room with guns to Mama's head and Patrick's head, and we were shaking so hard in our beds were knocking up against the wall.
After the men left, the girls found their mother, Norma Jean Norman, on the floor, bleeding from stab wounds. She survived, but her boyfriend did not. The Normans were relieved when Abdurrahman was given a death sentence in 1987. But then came the appeals, the hearings, the endless letters from the prosecutors. Katrina says she dreaded checking her mail.
I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to hear about it. If something comes on the news, I'm going to cut it off. I don't want to deal with it.
But last month, the sisters finally got closure when Abdurrahman waived his right to all future appeals. He'll still spend the rest of his life behind bars, but won't face execution.
I'm just glad that it's finally over. We've had to deal with this for a long time.
It took 32 years for Abdurrahman's case to wind its way through the courts. And evidence suggests death row inmates are waiting in prison longer than ever before. The Bureau of Justice Statistics' most recent report on capital punishment found that inmates executed in 2017 spent an average of 20 years and 3 months on death row. In 1987, the average was just over 7 years. Austin Sarrett is a law professor at Amherst College who studies the death penalty. He says capital cases take longer to resolve than they used to because of growing concerns about the execution of innocent people.
If we are going to carry out a death penalty, we want to be as close to certain as we can be that the death sentence is warranted and that the death sentence was arrived at respecting the full legal rights of the person whose life is now in jeopardy.
The Death Penalty Information Center reports the number of executions has decreased substantially in the past 2 decades, from 98 in 1999 to 25 last year. In most cases, Sarit says, death sentences are ultimately overturned. In the lengthy appeals process, he says, it's common to uncover evidence of prosecutorial misconduct at trial.
There is a lot of intense focus on the case, both in the media and obviously from the point of view of the surviving relatives. And that pressure can lead prosecutors to cut corners.
Sarit says defendants also regularly argue in their appeals that they didn't have proper legal counsel at trial, especially if they couldn't afford a private attorney. Both were true in Abdurrahman's case. His original defense lawyer admitted he didn't prepare in any way for the trial. Abdurrahman also claimed that the trial prosecutor withheld important evidence and rejected multiple potential black jurors. That's why Nashville District Attorney Glenn Funk decided to offer Abdurrahman a new deal. At an August hearing, he said there was enough doubt surrounding the death sentence in this case to throw it out.
Overt racial bias has no place in the justice system. Further, and most importantly, the pursuit of justice is incompatible with deception.
Abdurrahman's case could signal a path forward for Tennessee's three other inmates scheduled for execution in the coming months. Similar agreements could also offer relief for victims. Stacy Rector of Tennesseans for Alternatives to the Death Penalty says victims suffer when capital cases languish in court.
It's traumatizing. It goes on for so long. And what I often hear people say is, we just want some finality.
But after Abdurrahman's hearing, Rector said she doesn't think the solution should be to expedite death penalty cases.
There are too many issues that do not get addressed and that take years getting through the courts to finally get heard and addressed. And if you speed the process up, people like Abu Ali get executed.
As states like Tennessee grapple with the future of capital punishment, the federal government is pushing full steam ahead. In July, Attorney General William Barr announced that the Justice Department would resume executions after a lapse of nearly two decades. He said the Justice Department owed it to victims. The Norman sisters, however, say they understand why Abu Ali Abdurrahman's sentence was overturned. They haven't forgiven Abdurrahman, and they were looking forward to his execution in April. But they think the new deal will finally deliver some justice to everyone involved. For Here and Now, I'm Samantha Max in Nashville.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.